Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Enterprise value equals market capitalization plus total
asset
debt.
Asset pricing model equals risk-free rate plus
cost of
beta times
equals percentage of equity times cost of equity plus percentage of debt times cost of debt.
Not intimidated? Good. The sharpest minds succeed with London Business School's finance courses, ranked in the top five by the Financial Times. Find out which of our world-class finance courses are right for you by searching LBS Finance today.
Five women vying against each other.
Mountaineers who put everything on the line to follow their dreams.
To be the first to climb all 8,000 meter peaks.
The 14 highest mountains.
Amazing sports stories from the BBC World Service presents Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is Discovery on the BBC World Service.
Before we do the post-mortem today,
mm-hmm.
Got a little task for us both.
What are you going to make me do?
I'm not going to make you do anything. How fond are you of the phenomenon of cold water swimming?
Oh, I love the concept, but I hate the cold.
Ah, this might not work too well. It might work, I don't know. I've got a bucket of icy water here, and I want to see who can keep their hand in the longest.
Oh, no.
This thermometer? I haven't got my glasses on. How warm or cold is it in there?
2 degrees.
Okay, two degrees. Roll your sleeve up. When you're ready, after three, stick your hand in.
Okay.
3, 2, 1.
Over the past few episodes, we've been investigating the unique adaptations of flying and hopping animals by exploring their inner workings. We've seen one of Australia's largest animals, the red kangaroo, to one of the tiniest garden pests, the humble aphid. But we're starting things a bit differently this time and trying to experience just a fraction of what today's animal takes in its stride, or rather in its stroke, on a daily basis.
We're getting cold, presumably, and our bodies are desperately trying to keep warm, aren't they? So our skin will be reacting, the blood vessels beneath the surface of our skin will be constricting, and it is quite painful, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You've gone very quiet. Do you want to take your hand out yet?
No.
Are you sure? We are not built to be in cold water, are we?
I'm not.
And although we're not doing too well with this near-freezing water, today's animal comes from a group of flipper-footed marine mammals, or pinnipeds, which have learnt to perfectly traverse both icy waters and sunny beaches.
Mm. Why are you not making any noise? Oh, Ben.
This particular pinniped can normally be found lounging in groups of up to 1,500 on rocky coves or sandy beaches all along the western coast of North and Central America, or floating together in groups called rafts off the coastline. It's the California sea lion.
This isn't a competition. You can lose. There is a reason for this, because we have an animal today that wouldn't have a problem in doing what we're doing right now. An animal that's able to survive and actually thrive in very cold aquatic conditions. And these are the adaptations that I want to look at today.
Mm-hmm.
I guess one of us has to bring our hand out first.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm done.
You're done.
But to truly understand how sea lions have mastered both land and sea, we're going to have to take a look inside. I'm Dr. Ben Garrett, Professor of Evolutionary Biology and Science Engagement at the University of East Anglia. And together with friend and expert veterinary surgeon Dr. Jess French, we've taken the opportunity here in the university lab to open up and investigate what makes each animal we look at unique in terms of their extraordinary anatomy, behaviour and physiology.
Right, warm your hands up. This animal today is very different from anything we've done so far.
Yeah.
I'm excited for this one, as usual, but there are only a couple of things I really, really want to see in here. Very often I want to look at a whole suite of different adaptations. With this one, there's a couple of things that I really want to see. But this animal lives in really cold environments and is an amazing swimmer. In front of us today, we've got this gorgeous, she really is, this gorgeous female sea lion. I've never worked with a sea lion before. Jess, have you?
Live ones, yeah. I've had a little bit to do with them. Not heaps, but never done a post-mortem of one.
Luckily, we are joined today by May Betts, who is a zookeeper and trainer, and you specialise in carnivores, but also, in particular, with things like sea lions.
Yeah, I've worked with quite a few sea lions in the past.
So it'd be really interesting to have your perspective in terms of how you train them, why you train them for veterinary stuff as well, but also some of the adaptations that you've seen. Jess, what are we looking at first? These are streamlined animals, aren't they?
Yeah.
They've got to be beautifully hydrodynamic for what they do.
And really quite large as well. It can be hard to realise until you're up close to them just quite how big these animals are. How long do you think she is?
2 metres.
Oh, two metres. So she's 2 metres and she weighs 90 kilos, we've read somewhere.
84.
So 84 kilos. That's very approximately, before you say anything, my weight. And taller than me. Is this maximum size they get?
No, she's actually quite small for a female. Females average about 90 to kind of 100 kilos. Males, on the other hand, can get up to about 500 kilos, so they can get massive, yeah. Especially kind of peak breeding season. So obviously they've got to kind of fight each other for the good females.
And we see that it's not monogamous, is it? We see some animals referred to as beachmasters. So we have these big battles between these big, aggressive, huge males with multiple female partners. So they physically don't need to be as big as these big males who are fighting to the death, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. Kind of, you'll have one male with lots of lady friends around him.
What would that environment be like? I'm imagining it's a really noisy place.
Really noisy. They're really loud animals. The sea lions I work with are trained to bark and shout at us when that's really noisy. So imagining kind of thousands of them, it would be deafening. It'd be kind of awful.
Where would you typically find these animals in the wild, May?
This is a California sea lion, so she's predominantly found in California. You have like Galapagos ones as well. So they're found from kind of Mexico to Antarctica.
Quite a wide distribution, but these all specialise in coastal habitats, big colonies.
Yeah.
And these coasts are rough areas. I mean, we kind of think that they're going to the seaside is quite gentle and quite sweet, but from a biology point of view, the coast is an ever-changing, really hard-hitting, tough environment, isn't it?
Mm. And because they're living both on land and in the water, they've got this amphibious lifestyle, they have to have adaptations that work for both of those environments. These guys are trying to do both sides of that coin and do both sides well.
This beautiful sea lion is this wonderful sort of chocolate brown colour all
gorgeous
the way around her body.
But and covered in really thick fur.
That's it. I'm watching you now just run your finger.
It's like dog hair.
And that's because she's a mammal, and all mammals are hairy. But equally, that will be helping streamline her to be hydrodynamic, but also to trap some warmth in. They belong to the group, the eared seals, and it's quite clear why they've got these wonderful...
Oh, they're cute, aren't
they? Like Shrek ears.
Yeah.
They are.
I've never looked at them close up before like that. They're really quite rolled up, aren't they?
What's their hearing like? Is it possible to tell?
They do have quite good hearing on land and in the water. Some of their other senses are better than their hearing, but they do have quite good hearing.
And I suppose they're communicating with each other using vocalisations quite a lot, so they need to be able to hear those, don't
they? Definitely, especially out on the land, trying to pick out your pups.
Yeah.
Your pup sound or your mate sound or something like that.
You mentioned senses there, May. They've got these big, beautiful eyes. I'm guessing they're quite visually driven in terms of hunting, but also avoiding predators and communicating with each other as well.
Yeah, they've got really good vision in and out of water. So when they're on land, their pupils, they can go like the size of a pinhole. They'll be tiny. And like when they're hunting in the water, in the darkness, their pupils will like take over their eyes. They go massive.
They have particularly good far sight, but their near sight, I think, is not so good. Close up, they're using these incredible structures here.
Why they've got these beautiful whiskers.
Yeah, their whiskers are extraordinary. They're much thicker and longer and sort of more substantial than we'd see in dogs and cats. And what are they using those for?
So the whiskers, they're connected to a muscle, so they've got lots of nerves running through them. They can move them forwards and backwards, so they can feel like the vibrations of fish going through the water. They can kind of forage on the floor, so they can feel out different prey or like things to play with.
Amazing. And so they're under quite voluntary control. They can move them about.
Yeah, yeah. You can actually train them to kind of move their whiskers. I never have in the past. It's something I've always kind of wanted to do. But yeah, you can.
Incredible.
You've opened the mouth, Jess. There's a whole range of relatively sharp,
yeah,
quite pointed teeth. They do belong to the carnivore group.
They're quite dog-like teeth.
They
really,
are really, yeah. They're called sea lions, and as you were saying earlier, mate, they seem more like sea dogs. Because
no, the whole face is so dog-like, isn't
really
it?
Really dog-like, and as you say, the hair's very dog-like, the face is very dog-like, the teeth are really dog-like right now. But interestingly, they're black.
Yeah.
Yeah, so when they're born, like most other things, they'll have white teeth, but sea lions don't really have the same kind of plaque on their teeth as we do. So as they get older and more developed and they start eating kind of the fish and the proper food, the like good healthy bacteria builds up on their teeth, which turns them like a black colour. And yeah, that's kind of what protects them.
They're really jet black, aren't they?
I never knew they had black teeth, Jess, did you?
No, I didn't. Although I did know that, so just like us, they have a layer of baby teeth, which they lose, and then they get their adult teeth. But those baby teeth are actually resorbed when the baby is either in the womb or just after it's been born.
So they'll only use throughout their lives
this
functionally
one,
this one adult set of teeth. That's really interesting. Yeah. Right, Jess, can we have a look inside? I think my hand has recovered from our cold water exposure earlier.
Yeah, let's have a look.
Okay.
Got my blade here.
Absolutely.
Let's have a look what's inside.
And you're going from, as usual, throat down.
Yep, nice midline incision.
Already you've got that. Jess, that's lovely, isn't it?
Oh. Now,
first of all, what you're seeing there is a really, in the centre, an almost black layer of muscle.
The muscle's so
really
dark.
Really dark.
But before that, look at that incredible blubber layer. So thick.
So you can actually tell that this is a older sea lion. You'd expect kind of more of a blubber layer than this. This is quite thin.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
And that makes sense because blubber is an energy store. So when sea lions are going through hard times and maybe not eating enough, the blubber layer will really reduce because they're using it up for energy.
An interesting thing about these guys in the wild, their blubber can hold pollutants. Males will kind of hold on to their pollutants forever, whereas females, when they're lactating, they pass it on to their babies.
They have quite high cancer rates, don't they, sea lions? And they think that might be somehow linked
to pollution.
Yeah.
We're seeing this, it's called a bioaccumulation. And even around the UK, we're seeing some of our killer whales are, for want of a better phrase, dying off because of this toxic build-up, the pollutants going in the water, starting early on in the food chain into maybe crustaceans, then into fish, and then into seals, and then potentially into things like killer whales.
Yeah.
It builds up along that chain. But that's really interesting, whereas you and I are both going, wow, look how thick that is, and May's already saying it's not especially that thick. Either way, that's still much thicker than you'd ever see on a land mammal. We just wouldn't need it. I mean,
you'd be worried if a land mammal.
I would be
land
seriously.
Mammal,
yeah. I'd be doing my catch to 5K all over again if I was something like this. I think most of us see fat in a negative context. What are we actually looking at here, Jess? Why is this beneficial? What's going on with this layer?
So this is really insulating, and you can see it's really pale. It has very, very little blood supply, and that's to reduce loss of heat to the outside environment.
I mean, how thick are we talking there? We're all saying it's quite small, actually, or quite thin, but you're still talking 1, 2, 3, 4 fingers wide, so that's, what, 5, 6, 7 centimetres at its thickest point. Already it's quite nice to see how these animals are surviving in quite cold conditions.
I suppose it acts as a bit of protection as well. I mean, I'm not sure whether it would be protection from predation, but certainly the males can be quite aggressive, can't they, and do quite a lot of damage.
Yeah, definitely. It does act as a layer of protection from them, especially kind of peak breeding season when they're all kind of hauled up on the rocks, on the beaches and stuff. Also when they're swimming, that is where like a shark would probably come up and grab them from. So having a thick layer here would be really beneficial.
So already the sea lion would have won in our little competition to see if
we
could keep
there.
So these are pinnipeds, which are the seals in inverted commas. But there are several groups within that category, aren't there?
So you've got the eared seals, which are sea lions and fur seals. And then you've got your true seals, which are kind of all the other seals. And then walrus clipped on to the edge.
So they're vaguely similar looking, those creatures in the pinniped family.
Yeah.
But what do we have? What features of this animal here tell us that it's a sea lion?
Sea lions are a lot longer and slimmer. Seals are quite short and stout. If you look at the sea lions flippers. They're used for like propelling themselves through the water, so they're kind of as long as your tip of your fingers to the kind of crease in your elbow.
Yeah, they're really long.
Yeah, they're really long, whereas a seal is kind of just the size of your hand.
And in the water, it's mainly the hind flippers that seals are using to propel themselves, isn't
it? Yeah, so seals will use their hind flippers to move through the water, whereas sea lions will propel themselves with their front flippers. And then with their back flippers, they'll use it as a rudder. Sea lions also have different kind of hips to seals. So a sea lion's hip joints are like ball joints, so like ours, so they can tuck their flippers underneath them and kind of use them as a back leg, if you like, which makes them a lot better adapted to living on the land.
Yeah, they're completely different in the way that they move on the land, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely.
Seals are not agile at all.
They kind of do the worm, don't they, in a way?
Exactly.
But sea lions can walk quite comfortably on land. They can kind of outrun humans if they really try.
So I'm just cutting into the surface of the foreflipper here. Very little blubber.
We can see they haven't got any hair. They've got lots and lots of kind of capillaries, all that sort of thing. So like when they're hot, kind of stick it out the water to cool down. And when they're super cold, they can tuck them underneath their bellies to keep warm. So this is kind of the best point to try and lose heat, gain heat, that sort of thing. In captivity, obviously we do lots and lots of training. We try and focus on natural behaviours as much as possible. So during like demonstrations, talks, all that sort of thing, we can train them to put their flipper out the water and swim around, and you can say, oh, dum dum dum, is a shark.
We can train them for all sorts of things, can't we? Sometimes that can be really useful in a veterinary context to teach animals to present a certain part of their body, or to do you do any of those kind of training?
Yeah, so all of my sea lions are trained to open their mouth, take eye drops. They're trained to for x-rays and injections as well. Obviously she's an 80 kilo sea lion. Males are even heavier, so yeah, if you don't have that, then it's impossible to manage them.
Jess, when you sliced through that fat layer earlier, we went right down to this really dark muscle. I'd like to talk a little bit more about that. Why is it so dark?
Yeah, so they have heaps of what's called myoglobin. That's where they're storing most of their oxygen. When they're doing their deep dives, they've got very little circulation going on, so they want to make sure they've got a plentiful oxygen supply in their muscles already.
So that darker muscle means a higher concentration, a higher load of this myoglobin, which allows them to take on more oxygen.
Precisely.
Which is why we wouldn't see that if you cut my arm now, hopefully. You wouldn't see that inside.
It's much darker. Much darker in this sea lion, yeah.
Okay, are we able to look in the chest?
Yeah. They have an absolutely enormous rib cage with all of these extra floating ribs down the bottom, taking up almost the entirety of the body.
It's weird that the ribs extend right down, almost, well, right down to the pelvis almost.
Mm-hmm. You've got the abdominal organs within the rib cage.
Like I said earlier, this is a really vulnerable part of their bodies. So this is a lot of protection from sharks and any killer whales, anything else that kind of wants to eat them for dinner.
You almost think it would be constrained by a rib cage like this. But I guess, actually, that's a really nice point to seamlessly flow into our next bit there, Jess. They've got amazing rib cages, the pinnipeds, because they're able to manipulate them in a way that we can't. Is that right?
They have absolutely amazing ribs. So they have a hinge sort of midway down the rib cage, which allows them to compress the thoracic cavity and push out the oxygen that's contained within the alveoli, within the lungs, to get rid of it when they're trying to dive deep down in big dives.
So almost like a concertina that's able to push out all that extra unwanted air. And you say deep dive. You mentioned earlier, May, that these are deep diving animals. Again, I mentioned they're coastal, but they're equally able to go to really deep depths foraging as well, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely. So the deepest recorded dive of a sea lion is about 270, 280 metres. Their average is about 20 metres. They can also hold their breath up to 10 minutes, which is insane, which is obviously, like we see here, what their body is kind of designed to do.
And I guess at those sort of depths, you're risking things like the bends, getting nitrogen bubbles into the body,
definitely,
causing sort of toxic or fatal injuries as well here. So they've got these adaptations to try, first of all, try and squeeze out all that air to make sure they don't put themselves at risk.
Definitely.
What are you looking at, Jess?
So I've just cut down to expose one of these ribs, and they have this incredible adaptation halfway down the bone. And they actually have a hinge. The bone can bend to allow the entire rib cage to decrease in volume. to force out the air.
So typically on us, you follow my ribs round from my vertebrae at the back. It's one bone each time coming round and then joining to a piece of cartilage at the front that then joins my sternum, the bit in the middle. And there's a little bit of flex, but not a huge amount. But there's something different going on here. It's almost like there are two actual bones per rib joining and then flexing. And I'm doing the same on this side. The whole chest cavity slides back and forth. Having taken the lungs out, Jess, you can see these big, beautiful, very wide airways where the trachea comes into the bronchi here.
So the trachea itself is supported by cartilaginous rings and very, very solid. And that's important because when the lungs are being squeezed of all of their air, you want to make sure that a certain amount is contained in the upper airways. The lungs themselves are incredible because they have this amazing ability for the alveoli to be completely squashed and to force out all of the air that is contained within them. And you can see that these are quite pliable, squashable organs.
Lungs are never very, they're not solid in the same way that a liver is or a kidney, that the wonderful sort of static structure. But these do seem, as May said, quite squashy, even by lung standards. They're quite, they're almost fluid in a weird way, aren't they? And I guess that's that ability to be squashed down and emptied of as much air as possible.
Yeah, that's right. So when they're doing these deep dives, that's when they will contract their lungs. So until that point, it's an active movement of swimming down because they're still quite buoyant. They've got their lungs full of air. Then they breathe out this remaining air that's in their lungs and then they become negatively buoyant. So then they just sort of start to drift down to the lower depths.
We've had a good look in the chest or the thoracic cavity and we've started to open up the abdominal cavity now, but it is covered by ribs. Is it, you're fishing around in there, Jess?
Holy mackerel. that liver. Oh wait, it's still coming. No. That is absolutely enormous. I knew the liver was going to be big, but oh wow, it's so heavy. Have a feel of that.
I'd say that's about 3 kilos, 2 or 3 kilos easily.
Yeah, easily.
Probably more. Considering what the liver does, why does it need such a large liver then?
The liver's all about detoxifying. These guys are doing quite a lot of anaerobic respiration, so they're producing a lot of lactic acid, so it's probably processing some of that. And presumably some of the sea creatures that they are eating are producing quite a lot of toxins too.
But that's a lot larger than you were expecting to see.
I mean, I was expecting it to be big, but that's mammoth.
It's still in situ, but we can see, for want of a better phrase, the guts right now. But what I'm really surprised at, Jess, is the volume.
She's full of guts.
Of intestines, yeah. So in my mind, we've dissected herbivores. We've had alpacas and we've had other things in the past. Really long digestive tracts with lots of time to get that sort of very fibre-heavy diet digested. And the other end of the scale, we've seen big cats with really short digestive tracts that are get it in, get it out, bosh. This is much longer than I'd expect. Because they're carnivores, I assumed there'd be a shorter gut here.
Yeah.
And yet this is much longer than I anticipated.
And interestingly, compared to the dolphins and porpoises that we saw, which have a very similar diet, there's much more intestine here. And lots of relatively fine, small intestine. Just reams and reams of it, like a whole bowl of spaghetti bolognese.
It really is. I mean, you've put me off my dinner, but it's... You're just pulling out handfuls.
Yep, still coming.
And again, in my mind, the kidneys are also very large.
Yeah, the kidneys are really big for an animal of this size. They're also a really strange shape. They're reniculate kidneys, which they're sort of like a bunch of grapes, rather than in many mammals we'd see sort of a smooth surface. We saw a similar thing in the porpoise, where the bunch of grapes were sort of loose, whereas here they have sort of a capsule around them, and they have lots of tiny little grapes inside. This is a really specialist structure, isn't it, May?
Yeah, so they're like tiny little kidneys in the kidney. So it's all about conserving energy when processing kind of toxins and waste through there. So the tiny grapes, they'll kind of increase the surface area of the kidney, which processes things a lot faster. Sea lions don't drink kind of fresh water and they rarely drink seawater. they get all their water from their food. So the kidneys are really good at kind of processing the toxins. Anything they need to get out of their body, it'll be done really quickly with very minimal energy.
So that's maybe one of the reasons they have such a long digestive tract, is to reabsorb as much water as possible from the food that they're digesting.
So as we go past kind of the pelvis area, there's something very cute on their back flippers, which are very useful as well as cute. They've got little toenails.
Oh my goodness, sort of halfway up their rear flippers, they've just got these cute
enormous
little toenails poking out. How funny is that? Do they use those for anything?
Yeah, so they use them for scratching, itching, grooming, that sort of thing.
And they're really quite bendy, aren't they? They can bend those hind flippers round and use them quite a lot.
Their whole body is super bendy, so their head can touch their back flippers, so they quite literally can use these to scratch their heads, which is really cool. And I've noticed that this one in particular has a funny little toe as well.
An extra digit.
Yeah, an extra digit.
It's been really nice looking inside this animal, which is beautifully adapted to coastal habitats. I think living on the edge is something I'm getting from this animal. But this is an animal that's not committing to one particular type of environment, and instead it's just succeeding wherever it goes. I've learned a lot from this animal. What's been your favourite take-home from this, Jess?
I was really surprised by the size of the liver, and I absolutely loved its huge mobile whiskers. I think they're really sweet.
And May, any favourite points for you?
I just love the species as a whole, to be honest. I think pinnipeds they're just really cool. I've trained them for a long time and have so many nice relationships with them. But to see them kind of from the inside as well, it's just confirmed that they're definitely just up there with one of the best on the planet, really.
For me, it's got to be the ribcage. This ability to fold down in order to enable this animal to deep dive and not become injured or sick or develop sort of life-threatening conditions. With this flexible chest is just great. I've thoroughly gained a huge respect for an animal that's very often perceived as a bit of a clown, a bit of a comedian. This is an absolute pioneer in its environment.
Hope you've enjoyed this edition of Wild Inside for the BBC World Service. For all episodes from this and other series, just search for Wild Inside on BBC Sounds. With special thanks to Joe Wright from the University of East Anglia. Thanks also to executive producer Adrian Washbourne. This series is produced by Ella Hubber.
The mountains are what keeps me motivated in life.
It's where we get to ask ourselves who we are and who we want to become.
At the turn of this century, five mountaineers set out on individual missions to become the first woman to scale all 14 of the world's 8,000ers. 14 mountains, all above 8,000 meters.
It was about pitting themselves against nature rather than each other.
They knew only one of them would succeed, but whether they liked it or not, it would come to be seen as a race.
Five women vying against each other.
The media needed to find some competition. And they find it.
A race with deadly consequences.
We are just not designed to live in this environment. Getting down alive was my only goal in that situation.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story in Chasing Mountains.
Every step was an achievement.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.